This just does not work as health care reform.
Alaska senators weigh in on the health care bill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 23rd of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a unique alternative energy system goes up on a federal building in Juneau.
You know, we're trying to save energy. We always have wind. Might as well try to harness it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision, and people with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, with support from Lions Clubs.
Alaska's U.S. senators split their vote Saturday on whether to bring health care legislation to the floor. Democrats got exactly the 60 votes needed, with all party members lining up for it, and all Republicans voting against introducing it. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Some centrist Democrats are against the public option or government-run health insurance, but in the end on Saturday, every Democrat agreed to bring the bill to the floor for debate. Democratic Senator Mark Begich says the public option element is not the most important part of the bill to him, but he does want to see it improved so there's as little government involvement as possible. As it's currently written, states could opt out of the program. Even with that, the public option is contentious and disliked by Republicans. But Begich says he doesn't want to see legislation fall apart because of disagreement on one aspect. Instead, he says he's focused on other parts of the bill.
Insurance companies are held accountable that we have no longer denial on pre-existing conditions or no longer these lifetime caps that literally, for people who have catastrophic illness, puts them at a disadvantage, or ability to make sure we can have insurance that's portable between job to job.
Begich says he would not vote to pass the bill as it's currently written and wants to see it amended before he can support it. He wants more competition between insurance companies and lower prescription drug costs. And he says patients should be able to buy cheaper drugs from countries like Canada. Begich says problems must be worked out in the Medicare program. He also wants to let Americans access the health insurance Congress enjoys.
The other idea I would love to be able to offer up, and that is the idea that people could buy into the federal program just like any other program that might be offered up, because we hear a lot of people concerned that, you know, we have ours and everyone else will have to have something else. And my view is, well, why not just open up what we have and allow people to buy into it?
Begich says even though he's not fully on board with the current bill, it's time to get it out in the open on the Senate floor.
We were debating something we didn't have. And so everyone was saying, you know, this may be in there, this may be in there. My attitude now is get it on the floor, let's debate it, and I think there'll be modifications throughout this process, and it'll become a better bill. And my focus is going to be on the insurance reforms as well as making sure there's not undue hardship on the small business community.
Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski disagrees that the bill has a basic framework worth debating and says she's extremely disappointed in it.
I think what you saw play out on Saturday evening was a very strenuous objection by the Republicans to that base product, saying this just does not work as healthcare reform.
Murkowski says the bill was drafted without public input and fears it will cost far more than the estimated price tag of $850 billion in the first decade. She expects it to cost in the neighborhood of $2.5 trillion from 2010 to 2020. Murkowski says besides that, she thinks the biggest problem is that not enough is being done to bring down healthcare's cost.
As I've talked with Alaskans, their interpretation, or most people's interpretation of reform, is something that is going to change the status quo so that things are better for them. But if they are not going to see their premiums lowered, if they are going to see their taxes increased, then I don't believe that they think that this product is going to be better for them.
Murkowski says despite Republican dislike of the bill, her party does plan to engage and debate it on the Senate floor. Democratic leaders hope to see a bill passed by the Christmas recess in a month, but Murkowski says not so fast.
It's fair to say that there will be many amendments. There will be long and hard-fought debate on the floor. This is too big to try to rush through just because we've got a holiday approaching. So we got a lot of work ahead of us.
Senators are now on Thanksgiving break. They'll start debating health care legislation when they return next Monday. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
A federal judge in Washington, D.C. has ruled against the guided sport fishing industry in a lawsuit about Southeast Alaska halibut catches. A group of charter operators and lodge owners had hoped to overturn a regulation that cut their clients' daily bag limits in half last summer. But the court dismissed their case today. U.S. District Court Judge Rosemary Collier found that the Commerce Secretary and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration regulators had acted lawfully when they imposed a one-fish daily bag limit on guided sports anglers this year. The charter operators had claimed the agency violated a federal statute requiring that the allocation of the halibut harvest be fair and equitable. NOAA Alaska Region Attorney John Lepore helped defend the agency's decision.
Well, the main defense was that we, in fact, looked at all the relative considerations that were necessary under the statute when we took the action. And essentially, the plaintiffs were claiming that we didn't look at their impacts carefully enough. And the judge, when she went through the record, felt that we did provide a basis for our action.
The news was welcome to a group of commercial and subsistence fishermen, seafood processors, and community representatives that intervene as defendants alongside the government. The small southeast town of Pelican was among them. Pelican Mayor Patty Phillips is a commercial fisherman as well as a subsistence user.
My first concern is the resource, the halibut resource. That is here for the long term. That is here for everyone in the future. Pelican has been here, over 70 years, and it was founded on the principles of commercial fishing and subsistence. And, much of the industry is, the communities have been built on the backbone of commercial fishing.
As halibut abundance has declined, commercial halibut quota shareholders in Southeast have seen their allowable catch drop by 54% over the last few years. Meanwhile, the guided sports sector substantially exceeded a federal guideline harvest level in recent years. The judge's decision was a disappointment for the plaintiffs. Earl Comstock is the attorney for charter operators and says the ruling will have a long-term adverse impact in Southeast Alaska.
And the council who have come down squarely in favor of 1,200 individual fishing quota holders at the expense of the recreational fishing public. And the cost to Southeast Alaska will probably be, certainly several thousand, if not 30 or 40,000 fewer anglers coming to Southeast Alaska and spending their dollars in your towns.
Comstock says it's too early to say whether the charter operators will appeal the judge's ruling. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unusual rescue at an interior campsite near Talkeetna.
We do have some problems with some people who may go up to remote sites to live and not really be prepared to live up there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The Pro Pebble Mine Group, the Pebble Partnership, is asking to become a co-defendant in a case challenging the mine. If a judge grants the request, the partnership would join the State Department of Natural Resources in defending a management plan that is tied to development of the Pebble Project. KDLG's Adam Kane reports.
The tribes believe that the state's area management plan, which addresses approximately 12 million acres of land, was improperly changed in 2005 by changing the land use classifications for the vast majority of lands included in the plan. The DNR argued that the area plan was not a regulation but strictly a planning tool that sets standards for future action. The underlying target of the suit against the 2005 Bristol Bay Area Plan is the proposed Pebble Mine, which is located on some of the reclassified lands. Mike Heatwall is the Vice President of Public Affairs for the Pebble Partnership. He stressed that the motion was filed to give the Pebble Partnership an opportunity to take part in the matters that ultimately relate to Pebble's interests.
Basically, we were just wanting to file to have a seat at the table in a matter that's clearly trying to stop our project from advancing. And so a motion to intervene allows us to do that. It's similar to what we are also doing in the matter of the trustees' litigation against the Department of Natural Resources about the state of Alaska's mineral exploration program. We sought intervention status there, too, so that we can have a seat at the table when decisions are made in that case.
Jeff Parker is an Anchorage-based attorney representing the plaintiffs, which include the six Bristol Bay area tribes, as well as the Alaska Independent Fishermen's Marketing Association and Trout Unlimited. Parker believes that if the Pebble Partnership is allowed to be part of the case, they would take on the difficult responsibility of defending the sensitive issues that may arise.
If they become a defendant on the side of the state, as they're trying to do, they will have to defend the 2005 Bristol Bay Area Plan. And that's likely to be difficult because the 2005 Bristol Bay Area Plan contains many questionable provisions.
Assistant Attorney General for the State of Alaska, John Baker, said that the state did not take a position on Pebble's motion to intervene and did not oppose the extension request by either the tribes or the Pebble Partnership to brief the issue. The suit was originally filed in May of this year on behalf of the Non-Dalton Tribal Council, the Kliginik Village Council, the Noosduyahok Traditional Council, the Akwak Council, the Chogyong Tribal Council, and the Leavelock Village Council. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
Cruise ships discharged more pollution into Alaska waters last summer. State reports show a 70% increase in violations from the previous season. But regulators, the industry, and its critics say it's a small figure compared to the overall number of samples tested. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The state checks water discharged by cruise ships while they're traveling the Inside Passage in the Gulf of Alaska. When pollution levels exceed legal limits, regulators issue notices of violation. This year, the Department of Environmental Conservation sent out 32 notices, a 62% increase over the previous season. And this year's notices detailed 61 separate over-limit discharges, a 74% jump. State Cruise Ship Program Manager Denise Koch says the change was in the ships, not the testing program.
We have a quality assurance, quality control plan that ensures that the samples are taken in the correct manner and that they're analyzed in the laboratory in the correct manner. In both years, they operated under the same plan. They sampled with the same amount of frequency. They just had more violations in 2009 than in 2008 for wastewater.
The Alaska Cruise Association views the issue differently. President John Binkley says the violation numbers are extremely low when compared to the large number of tests conducted.
We achieved over a 98% compliance rate for almost 3,400 tests that were done on the different constituents that were discharged from the ship. So we were very pleased with that. We thought the season went very well, and we're continuing to improve the systems and look for new technologies that are out there and operational practices that can do even better than 98%.
The state says those numbers are wrong. Koch says a little less than 1,800 tests were conducted, giving about a 96.5% compliance level. But overall, she agrees that the vast majority of discharges were within legal limits. Koch says most of the violation notices, 26 of 32, went to just one line.
Princess has the largest fleet of dischargers in Alaska, but even accounting for that, Holland America has a couple of fewer ships than Princess, and they don't have nearly the number of wastewater notices violation.
Princess Cruises admits its ships have a problem meeting limits for ammonia, which is found in sewage. The line's Bruce Bustamante says it's due to a new program aimed at reducing onboard water use.
One of the results of that is that then we have a higher ammonia concentration with the treated wastewater. And there are trade-offs that come with that, but one thing that we're doing right now, and really in collaboration with ADEC, is working with our wastewater treatment plant manufacturer, Hamworthy, on an ammonia reduction plan.
The Department of Environmental Conservation sampled the 19 ships that discharged within state waters last summer. Another dozen vessels were not tested because they discharged outside state waters. Cruise lines can be fined up to $200,000 for each day they exceed discharge limits. The state has taken no action so far beyond issuing the violation notices. Koch says that may not happen until early next year. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
A public meeting is being held in North Pole tonight to update residents on an old chemical spill that's tainted some local groundwater. The contamination is from an historic spill of a solvent called sulfalane at the Flint Hills oil refinery. The chemical has been detected in one of two wells that feed the city's public water system. The affected well has been taken offline. It's unclear how far the contamination has spread. Department of Environmental Conservation statewide drinking water compliance manager Cindy Christian says sulfalane concentrates have been very low.
They're in parts per billion range, and the level that was found, for instance, in the well that was affected in the city of North Pole was at 23 parts per billion. So it's a very, very low level.
Sulfalane is used to strip aromatic hydrocarbons from crude oil. It was developed by Dow Chemical Company in the early 1960s. Christian says it's unclear how big a health threat the North Pole contamination is. The public meeting is happening at the North Pole High School auditorium at 7 tonight. The spills believed to be the source of the groundwater contamination date back as far as the mid-1980s when the sulfalane extraction unit went in.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Eighty-seven communities in Alaska will get a budget boost from the federal government within the next week as the state mails out about $14 million in grants from the Government Services Fund. The fund is part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that was approved first by Congress and then by the legislature earlier this year. Those 87 communities are part of 103 applicants for the money that's distributed on a per capita basis, roughly calculated at $30 per resident. Diane Burns, internal auditor with OMB, says the first recipients will get their payments on Wednesday.
The key thing in the accountability is that it's on a reimbursement basis. And so the communities will be sending in their receipts for whatever they've purchased that's under the ERA bailiwick. And then a decision will be made whether to reimburse them or not. It's not here, we're cutting you a check, have a good time.
Burnham says there is still about $6 million available for communities that have not yet sent in their applications. She says the most common use for the money is fuel purchases. NOAA's Juneau facilities are going green in an effort to reduce diesel fuel consumption by 75%. Maintenance staffs are busy making mechanical modifications to buildings, installing pumps to extract heat from seawater, and putting up a mini farm of wind turbines with a unique design. KTOO's Casey Kelly caught up with a crew as they installed one of the wind systems.
As the clock chimes 12 o'clock, Mike Anderson works a ratchet jack at the end of an old pier at NOAA's downtown port facility. A rope runs from a hook on the jack to the top of a 9-foot steel tower. Bolted to the top of the tower is a 20-foot cylindrical object made from aluminum that resembles a wheat thrasher you might find on the front of a tractor. This is the Wind Spire, a 30-foot-tall, 4-foot-wide, vertically designed turbine by Mariah Power. The more Anderson pumps the jack, the higher the Wind Spire climbs. Right on cue, a gust of wind comes along just as Anderson, Tommy Abbas, and Mark Hoover lifted into place.
So it'll get slightly louder than that, but not much.
Anderson, Abbas, and Hoover are maintenance mechanics, the guys who keep NOAA's Juno buildings running smoothly. They put up another wind spire at the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute at Off Bay 2 weeks ago. That building will eventually have 3 turbines, while the downtown facility will have 2. This one will power a weather station.
It's an effort that everybody's trying to get to, trying to achieve. Save energy. You know, we're trying to save energy. And these systems are readily available. We always have wind. Might as well try to harness it.
Each wind spire costs $6,500 and is capable of producing 1.2 kilowatts of electricity, about enough to power your average electric space heater. But Mariah Power spokeswoman Amy Berry says over time it adds up.
That's an instantaneous power rating, so 1.2 kilowatts at 25 miles an hour. What's probably a more important number is how much energy it'll produce. And what we've found from our independent test site is that in 12-mile-per-hour average winds over the course of a year, you can expect to generate about 2,000 kilowatt-hours a year. That's 20 to 25% of the average U.S. house.
Berry says more than 450 Mariah Power turbines have been installed in the U.S., mostly on homes. But she says many business and government buildings have them as well. That includes a bank in Chicago, a car wash in Oklahoma, and the governor's mansion in Michigan, even a lodge in Toke. Berry says most people comment about the unit's unique design.
When people first see it, they're really taken back by it because they've never seen anything quite like it. And they're not even sure how it will actually work. And then when you see it spinning, it's just it's a bit mesmerizing with the aluminum airfoils spinning so quickly but not making any noise. It kind of pulls you in to stare at.
Berry says while traditional horizontal axis windmills continue to dominate the wind power industry, vertical axis turbines like the Wind Spire are catching on.
We were at the Small Wind Energy Association show in Detroit a few weeks ago, and it was full of guys with really and girls with really great ideas for new vertical access machines. It'll be interesting to see how many actually turn into, you know, really viable and affordable wind turbines. But certainly the vertical access design allows wind power to go in more places than the traditional.
Back at Juno's NOAA dock, Mike Anderson takes a moment to appreciate the Wind Spire as it continues to spin.
It's sort of appealing to the environment. It's not this large, you know, obvious thing that's that catches your eye, but it's low profile. It's tall but very narrow, and they don't take up a lot of space. And they're aesthetically pleasing.
NOAA Facilities Manager Jack Christensen estimates it'll take 12 years to recoup the cost of the Wind Spires. But he says they're already two-thirds of the way toward their goal of a 75% reduction in diesel use. Depending on Juno's experience with the Wind Spires, other NOAA facilities in Alaska and the lower 48 are likely to install them. In Juno, I'm Casey Kelly.
Talkeetna emergency responders and the Matsu Borough Animal Control teamed up on Saturday to rescue 13 dogs, including 6 newborn puppies that were abandoned at a remote campsite near Talkeetna. Deanna Hecker has the story.
A week-long ordeal that involved the remote rescue of a woman and a dozen abandoned dogs came to an end Saturday with a somewhat happy ending. 3 people trying to overwinter in a remote campsite off the North Fork of Montana Creek were ill-prepared for the harsh conditions and the below 20 degrees temperatures. They had walked in earlier last week to their campsite on a rough 7-mile trail and set up a makeshift wall tent with a wood stove, but they had a tough time staying warm. On Tuesday, the troopers were notified by a person who went to visit them by dog team and crashed his sled, injuring himself in the process. The person reported that the woman was in need of medical assistance. EMS personnel were dispatched. Talkeetna Fire Captain Tim Morgan responded.
We had a rescuer dispatched Tuesday evening for a female who was up there with her husband and child that had some frostbite to her hands, and so we went up there that night. We went up at sub-zero temperatures in the dark. It was a bit challenging, low snow conditions, lots of obstacles, etc. We went in, made contact with her, transported her out. The other family members at that point in time, the information we had were that they were fine.
The rescuers got Judith Willems out and transported her to Mutsu Regional to be treated for severe frostbite. Rescue personnel said that the man, Peter Heim, and the teenager seemed to be okay and left them there.
Since that point, they have come out due to the conditions, the challenging conditions, etc., and they were unable to bring their animals, and that's why we're going back in.
As the light came up on Saturday morning, the rescue crew got on their snow machines, towing sleds loaded with dog kennels and supplies. After 1.5 hours, they reached the site.
The animals seemed overall to be doing fairly well. They were stressed from being out in the conditions, and they hadn't been fed probably a day or 2 days.
Rescue personnel and troopers say this has been an unusual situation, as rescues usually involve people who recreate in the backcountry. Animal Control Chief Bob Haskell said this is the season for calls like this. However, the remoteness of last weekend's rescue made this an unusual incident.
We do have some problems, especially at the start of winter, with some people who may go up to remote sites to live and not really be prepared to live up there. So, you know, at the start of winter, we'll take a few calls similar to this.
As for Judith Willems and her son, troopers say they are still being treated at Providence Hospital in Anchorage for severe frostbite. In Talkeetna, I'm Diana Hecker.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Adam Kane in Dillingham, Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Deanna Hecker in Talkeetna. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Help manage subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local federal subsistence regional advisory council. The deadline to apply is January the 8th. For more information, call 800-478-1456. This announcement is sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management.
Ilagajugufji Regional Council Lanun Una Nambakka Lagalugu 800-478-1456 Application at Humchikut January 8 Dami Una Kankigun Khtuk U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management Anchorage Jamuk.
People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision, and people with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, with support from Lions Clubs.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.